Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets from the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on the show, join us for a tour of Carol and Frank Morrison's farm in Pocomoke City, Maryland. If you've seen the movie Food, Inc. or listened to our episode taped at screenings of that film, you're already familiar with Carol. She and Frank were Purdue chicken growers who decided they wanted to rework operations on their farm. They now have a flock of around 550 pastured Rhode Island red laying hens, and we spoke with them about the process of transitioning into this new mode of farming. Here's Carol, who took us down to the chicken house to take a look at the birds and see how the new operation uses some of the infrastructure from their days as Purdue growers.
There are hundreds of thousands of birds and usually Mount Air or Purdue operation or whatever, Dyson.
Right.
So you only have 550. You can make a living on this?
Yes. There's a high demand for this type of a product. At this point, the demand outweighs the supply. We started with the 550, and, you know, it's possible we'll expand to more. We have plenty of room. So we're going to see how this goes. We have buyers who are interested. And, you know, we're going to go from there. And we're hoping that other, you know, maybe some other farmers on the peninsula will pick up the idea.
Maybe you could set a co-op and release.
Well, it would be up to them, you know, co-op, whatever. I like to call it a food distribution network.
Uh-huh.
Where not just chicken, but, you know, kind of like everything that's grown, to, you know, develop a network and a distribution chain where you can ship across the bay all together, cut down on costs, you know, that type of thing. And there are hundreds of empty chicken houses on the peninsula. People who no longer raise for one reason or another. You know, and this is a way that you could use the buildings. And we were to the point, these houses stood empty for 3 years. And it was to the point that, you know, we're looking at the buildings and saying, okay, we're either going to sell, we're going to burn them down, or we're going to do something with them. And I had seen enough over the past year or so around the country, different kinds of farming. Actually, there's a lady out in California who really inspired me. She had about 4,000 pasture birds. Laying and meat birds mixed.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I saw that there was an opportunity where it wasn't really your backyard flock with just 25 birds, that you could do it on a larger scale and, you know, make a living from it. So, yeah, we're pleased with it.
So you learned a lot in these last few years.
Oh, my, yes.
That you didn't know
Oh,
before.
My, yes. This is all new for the entire family. I mean, you know, letting birds out of the chicken house is just a shock. so you never let the birds out. But, yeah, I mean, it's a learning experience. We've never done eggs before.
And they've just gone in.
Run in and out as they please. You know, we've cut, I'll show you when we go in, we have cut door, you know, access doors in addition to the side doors so that they have plenty of access in and out, and they just pretty much do as they want, you know, whatever they're comfortable with. And then we close them up at nighttime, you know, because of predators, foxes mostly. You know, they're safer inside than outside, so
right. That's
the only time that they're closed up is during the nighttime hours. They're very friendly chickens.
Yeah. If we walk down there a little ways,
you'll see, will be mobbed by chickens.
Good.
Because they think everyone has come
like
to
that.
See them.
Like
kind of like our dog.
Yes. I mean, a typical industry bird, they couldn't walk this far. They take a couple steps and plop right down. You know, their hearts and circulatory system can't handle that that load.
I mean, so, when we had chickens that were large right before going to slaughter, when we were under contract, they could take maybe 5 to 10 steps before they would just plop down, totally exhausted. And they stayed that way until they moved, simply because they were so heavy, and their bones and whatnot had not kept pace with
the rut. Like when you were raising for Purdue.
Yes.
I saw some Purdue chickens recently. I mean, there was some room, and the birds were running, and they were kind of playing with each other. And
so it depends what age they are. If they're young birds, they move around. Probably up until about, I'd say, 5 weeks, then they really start to show the I call it lethargy. They just don't want to do anything but eat and drink and plop down. And then it's as they grow, it starts to get really crowded. And, I mean, it's wall-to-wall chickens like a carpet. You know, we used to have to walk through when they were large, and I called it the chicken shuffle. You had to shuffle your feet because the chickens would not get up out of the way as you were walking through. And, you know, you'd step on them. And especially with the way the housing is now, ours is, I guess you'd call the older style, because we still have curtains that raise, you know, and lower according to weather conditions, and it allows it in the sunlight and fresh air. And with the industrial birds, now they want everything closed up. It's totally, well, not totally dark, but, you know, my husband said he didn't sign up to work in a mushroom house. So that is why the birds don't get up, because they're docile with the low lighting.
Yeah, it's very low lighting in there.
Very low, yes. And you know, there's...
Well, they're saying that was better for the chicken, to allow the chicken to be more comfortable and...
The chicken, the benefit to the low lighting and the chicken not running around is that they are not expending energy, which, of course, is feed. The highest cost in raising the chickens is the feed, and they want to convert feed to pounds of meat as quickly as they can to get them to market. And that is the only benefit of the low lighting. Now, with ours, we do nighttime, you know, their lighting goes with the natural sunlight and darkness. And we do provide a little bit of lighting, you know, when it first gets dark now with the less daylight hours. But the thing is, at nighttime, they go to sleep. In the morning, they wake up when the sun rises, and, you know, they go about their business. So they're doing a more natural living, and I don't see where it benefits the birds, except they grow faster if it's dark.
So what is the difference between the chicks delivered to you, these birds, and the chicks you had delivered when you...
Well, these are an old breed, and they don't, for one thing, they don't grow as fast. They grow at a much slower pace, so that they are not putting on a lot of weight, which their internal organs and their, you know, bones and whatnot cannot deal with. These birds here produce under 300 eggs a year, each one of them. We just were certified for animal welfare approved program. It's the strictest third-party certification for animal welfare in the country. We set up the houses when we first started because I had planned on doing it. And when we set the houses up, we did it according to what their standards were so that we could apply for the certification.
Okay. So this house we're looking at now that we're in,
mm-hmm.
when you were in Food, Inc.,
mm-hmm.
this would be one of the houses you walk through.
Yes.
And the argument was that then these were windowed houses.
Exactly.
And they were moving to windowless houses.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that was what you objected to in the beginning.
Yes, we refused to do it. Purdue told us either do it or they would terminate our contract. We refused to do it for several reasons. You know, first of all, the cost to us to do it, which we would have never recouped. You know, by the time we got done with entirely closing the houses, we would have had to put in a heavier electrical service to handle the additional electrical load. We would have had to drill a new well, larger, to supply more water. And by the time we finished, it was about $150,000, and we just flat out said no. We weren't going to do it. We were doing well with Purdue. We were making them money, so it was kind of silly, you know, to even do anything. What we were already doing was good. Ironically, a few weeks before we received our letter of termination from Purdue, they awarded us with the Outstanding Producer Award.
Does that mean you produced more chickens than other people?
No, that means we did better than anybody else.
What does better mean?
Better means we converted, the objective is to convert pounds of feed into pounds of meat moved off the farm, and how cheaply you do that, what I call the inputs, such as feed, you know, you don't use that much to convert, and you're making the company more money. That's about what it comes down to. You know, they wanted us to use nothing but electricity to raise the chickens instead of utilizing your natural surroundings. And I thought it, well, we both thought it was absolutely stupid. You know, everybody's supposed to be cutting back on fossil fuel usage. And to me, that was just using more.
When did the two of you start wrestling with the idea of farming the way you were farming with Purdue? I mean, did it come about when the whole house thing erupted? And,
yeah.
And what was the history of that for you?
It was a thing that built up. Actually, it started probably back in the early 90s with the contracts.
And how long have you been with Purdue?
We were with them for 23 years.
Okay.
But it started in the early 90s. Growers were organizing across the country to try to get some changes in the contracts because they're non-negotiable. Frank got involved with that, and that kind of pulled me into it. And then the next big thing was in 95, we had Fisteria here. You know, manure was the culprit, too much nutrient overload in the water. And, you know, there was a lot of denial, and it was clear to me that the environmental community and the farming community did not have an understanding. Neither knew how the other worked. So Frank and I went to a press conference here in Pocomoke that they were doing.
This was in the 90s?
In 95.
95.
Actually, it was the Chesapeake Bay Foundation that was here doing a press conference. They had toured the Pocomoke River where the Fisteria outbreaks were. And we approached, you know, them afterwards and started talking about how the contracts were and how the growers were having to shoulder the entire burden of the manure. And you know, the relationship with the environmental community kind of started then. They had no understanding of how the contracts worked. They just thought it was the damn farmers doing it again. And the industry, poultry industry, was more than happy to let the farmers take the blame rather than it be any part of the company, you know, that they had any blame to shoulder or any responsibility for cleaning it up. So that kind of, you know, went along. Then I went to work first as a volunteer with the Delmarva Poultry Justice Alliance, and that was a community organization. And it brought together the environmentalist, animal welfare interest, excuse me, the religious community, consumers, farmers, chicken catchers, and plant workers. It was the first time I had ever sat down at a table with a chicken catcher. And it was a learning experience. It took us 2 years to finally get a cohesive organization going, you know, where everyone trusted the other. And
you were still farming for Purdue then?
Yes, yes. And then I became executive director of the organization in 97. They're fighting with each other. They do that. They do it all the time. that's what you call establishing the pecking order. No, for real, it is.
Right.
That's where that came from. But anyway, I became executive director of the organization, and we did a lot of work around worker issues and the chicken catchers. Of course, Purdue had declared them independent contractors in the early 90s, and in the late 90s, one of the participating organizations in the Poultry Justice Alliance filed suit against Purdue in federal court. And a federal judge, it's a feeder. That's the feed being distributed. And that lawsuit was won. Federal judge did rule that the chicken catchers were indeed employees of the company. From there, it went to Tyson, Mount Air, and Allen's here on the peninsula, and getting, you know, the chicken catchers back on as employees instead of someone just making the declaration, no, you're an independent contractor. Then they sued for unpaid wages and recovered them. They recovered retirement benefits that they had lost, you know, all of that. So that was some of the work that I did.
It must have been eye-opening in some ways and consciousness-raising for you to all of a sudden be in a room with environmentalists and chicken catchers, and who are mostly Black and Latino workers, right? And
they, yes.
I mean, who come from another world.
Total different world, yeah. It was eye-opening, to say the least, and actually I felt ashamed of myself because I had these preconceived notions about people. And then after sitting down, you know, around a table and everyone, you know, having a give-and-take conversation, to be honest with you, as I said earlier, it was the first time I ever had a conversation with a chicken catcher, although they were on the farm every 7 weeks catching chickens. And there was always this friction that went on, and, of course, you know, the catchers were Black males at that time, and, you know, the companies would tell the catchers, well, you see that white woman there, she can't stand you people, or, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they would say to the catchers, well, you know, all's they think is you're going to steal their stuff. And then they would come to the farmer and they would say, well, you got to keep an eye on them because they tear stuff up and they steal things. And that was my preconceived notion. So it kind of kept people apart. And I find that the industry does that. They work people against one another so that, you know, God help them, should everybody get together, there might be a problem. So this is kind of what the idea was around the Poultry Justice Alliance. Instead of everyone, you know, fighting with one another when they all had a common denominator, you know, let's see if we can't make some changes. So, yeah, it was eye-opening. And as I said, I was ashamed of myself.
So what was the company saying to you during this 15-year or 10-year period when you were working with the Poultry Justice Association and you were starting to get involved in all these other issues while raising chickens for Purdue? What were they saying to you?
Well, it became very evident, you know, that every time either one of us were outspoken, and we were able to show this on a graph and give it to USDA, that every time there was a newspaper article or a television thing or we spoke out, we had a bad flock of chickens. And you could see this graph that constantly went up and down, up and down, up and down, and you could coincide it with...
You were given a bad flock or your flock was deemed bad?
It was deemed bad. You know, given a bad flock is easy to do. You have other, you know, some chickens perform better than others. Some might be sick or, you know, they're not as healthy as what others get. And it's a lot harder to bring them along and raise them to a marketable age. There's so many ways, and there's no checks and balances. There's nothing that's verifiable. I could not go to Purdue and say, well, I don't want this breed of chicken, I want that breed of chicken. It was whatever. Well, they have their different, what they used to label them as A and B breeds. And I'm sure there were differences in their genetics. You know, they've mixed them up so much, it's kind of hard to tell what they are. So, yeah, there were many ways to do that. We noticed that going on. It actually got to the point that we just didn't care. You know, we were going to say what we had to say. There came a time that I asked myself one day while in the chicken house, how did I get to be like this? And it was a matter of me coming in the chicken house and picking up dead chickens every single day, or being told to kill chickens, call them, as they call it, you know, because they weren't uniform, of the chickens being just crammed in and nobody could move, not human or animal. You know, I was tired of Purdue coming on the farm as if they owned it and were paying the mortgage on it and telling us what to do. You know, it was a constant thing. You have to do this, this, and this. And it wasn't farming, you know. And over the years, I guess it kind of built. And I just finally said one day, how did I get to be like this? I didn't care. I hated it.
So one thing I've noticed in the chicken house is the odor mm-hmm. is different than
much different.
What I smelled in the
You're not smelling ammonia at all.
No, there's no ammonia smell. So why is there no ammonia smell here?
Well, number one, we have fresh air circulating. Number two, the chickens are outside as well as inside. They're not packed in here 24 hours a day for 7 weeks. You know, if you take 3/4 of a square foot, and that's being generous towards how crammed in industry birds are, you know, you're talking about a sheet of paper size for each chicken to live their entire life.
So one of the things that was argued about the chicken houses was that when the houses are built, constructed, so the light is low and and it's dark inside, the windows are all shut, and they have these little vents that they open and shut to let fresh air in, and they have these fans. Mm-hmm. Is that in the long run is healthier for the chicken? Because it keeps them out of the elements, and that the chickens don't die off in the summer because of humidity and heat.
Oh, those arguments are great. you know, number one, cramming anything into a confined and totally enclosed space, you're going to breed disease. I mean, let's say you've got 30,000 chickens crammed into a space that never see the light of day. The only fresh air they get is through fan exchange of air. And they live in there for 7 weeks. If you took people and did the same thing, just as an example, anything, and put it in a space like that with less than a square foot of living space, you're going to have disease breeding. That's why they have to feed them full of antibiotics or antimicrobials all the time because of disease. Secondly, I don't see how putting an animal into something like that is better for the animal. These chickens here are a hardy breed. Their genetics haven't been messed with to the point of, oh, we want to get a big breast or we want a big drumstick or whatever. You know, or we want them to grow in 6 weeks instead of 7. They're hardy chickens. They're bred for this. They love cold weather. During the summertime, we have plenty of air flowing. We have fans that we can use. They can come in and out as they please. They adapt very easily to weather conditions. I just don't buy this thing about, you know, it's better for them to be confined because it's better for the health of the chicken.
So one of the things, of course, Americans have gotten used to, all of us, is being able to buy our food rather inexpensively. Mm-hmm. And a huge part of our budget goes to buying food. So will there ever be a time, from what you can see, think about this, where somebody can afford eggs like this? Like the chicken catchers, or like your neighbors could afford the egg, or somebody who's just a truck driver who's, you know, trying to get his family through can afford to eat the kind of food.
There's two answers to that question. And first, yes, I do think that it can be affordable food. Number one, all of your, or the majority of your farmers markets are now accepting what I call food stamps. You know, they can people who are on assistance can purchase at the farmers markets and utilize it that way. I've seen programs in D.C. There are a couple of programs going on where the farmers are coming to the neighborhoods, you know, school bus, truck, whatever, and, you know, the neighborhoods who, what they call, are food deserts that don't have access.
Right.
And I see that happening. Secondly, if we really look at the cost of it, with the cheap food or your cheap chicken, whatever, if we look at how it is subsidized and add in all the what I call the external costs that people don't see that they're paying for, actually, for that food. You know, we're paying farm subsidies for farmers to grow corn below the cost of production, a government program, so that these companies can purchase feed at a cheap cost. That's subsidized. That's an indirect subsidy to the poultry industry. If you look at the environmental costs with all of the taxpayer dollars that are going into all these environmental initiatives to handle poultry manure on the peninsula, that's a cost. Add that to your cost of that cheap chicken. Health costs, public health costs. You know, there's so the antibiotic resistant bacteria and chicken houses have been a breeding ground for it, where there are antibiotics that no longer work. These are all things that have cost us. And in some way, shape, or form, gone to help for that cheap chicken. If you wipe all of that out, don't supply it, and make the industry pay for their responsibilities, it's going to crumble. It is a system that is going to crumble.
So what about the manure on your farm? How is that different than what happens to manure on a
massage?
So what's how about that that issue?
We have way less chickens. I mean, you know, we used to raise 54,400 birds in one flock.
Per house?
No, 27,200 per house, so a total of 54,400. We now are raising roughly 550, you know. Yes. So there's a big difference. Secondly, we're rotating them on the land, and what we're feeding them is not anything that's detrimental to the soil. It's good for the soil. You know, we don't have all the additives in there, so we don't have to worry about that. Runoff is not a problem because they're not producing that much manure. So there, I feel really good about what we're doing. You know, we used to worry about what our contribution was to the degradation of the Chesapeake Bay. I have always said, as a matter of fact, I think I was probably the first one to raise my hand and say, yes, I did it, I'm part of the problem, instead of all this arguing about who's responsible and who's not responsible. You know, that part right there really aggravates me, because I'm tired of everybody wasting time and money on arguing about who's responsible. We know we have a problem, let's clean it up. So I feel good about what we're doing. And I in no way envision that we will ever get to the point where we will be a problem with runoff.
You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. Don't go away, because we'll be right back after this very brief break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. This week we're talking with Carol and Frank Morrison, who recently transitioned from industrial chicken farming into raising a smaller flock of pastured laying hens. As we left the chickens and walked back to our house, I asked Carol why she wrote about the lawsuit against the Hudson family and Purdue on her blog, which you can find at oldfarmerlady.wordpress.com.
Well, the total control over the farm, number one. And, you know, it kind of came out in some of the court records about the control that the company has over the farm. It was a constant thing here, and I always felt like this wasn't our farm. It was Purdue's farm, and our checkbook was just open for them to say where to spend our money. You know, and I had a feeling from the very beginning that the farmer, the Hudsons, were going to end up being thrown under the bus, so to speak. And that's come out in the court documents, where Purdue had some internal emails saying that the Hudson farm was one of their 10 worst farms. So they're trying to distance themselves from the farmer instead of it being, we're in this together. And if Purdue knew that the Hudson Farm was 10 of their worst farms that they contract with, why were they still contracting with them?
And when they said Allen Hudson's farm was one of the worst farms, what does worst mean? Worst in terms of production?
Well, they were talking about curb appeal, which
curb appeal, which
has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with how you raise a chicken. And, you know, there was one farmer who made a joke, well, what's going to be next? Do they have a nice smile? You know, those types of things. Is the farm, does it have curb appeal to have a Purdue Lane sign sitting at the end of their lane?
Curb appeal.
And that has nothing to do with how a farmer raises a chicken. You know, you could have the oldest houses there were and still be raising a good product for the company and making them money. But if it doesn't have curb appeal, it's looking like they don't want anything that isn't appealing.
So what did you mean you think that they're throwing them under the bus?
Well, for them to be discussing the Hudson's, you know, as to ways that they could separate themselves, that really bothered me, and I knew it was going to happen eventually. I didn't realize how quickly it had happened until the court documents were released to the public. And I started reading through them and came upon this internal email in Purdue, and they were identifying their worst farms. And Allen Hudson's farm was on the farm.
That's right.
Or on the list. That's and it was like, okay, so here we go. He was a bad grower, and, you know, we wash our hands.
They could even control the sale of your farm.
Yeah.
If you decided you wanted to sell your poultry farm and you found a buyer. So that buyer is going to have to go to an integrator to see if he can get chickens. So then the integrator would probably say, oh, yeah, they come out there, oh, yeah, they need this equipment, they need that equipment, you'd have to do this and you'd have to do that. Or they could label the farm as bad curb appeal, like was just stated, or they could say that it was that area has a lot of disease problems. So it all goes back to them again.
I don't know the Hudsons, and I am not going to say one way or the other, oh, they're bad growers, they're good growers, they're this, they're that. I don't know the people.
Right.
All I know is what I read in court documents, and to me, the company is throwing the grower under the bus.
And I'll leave the best up to some part of the commitment when this is all over with.
The Hudsons will no longer have a contract, especially if they're 10 of the... one of the 10 worst farms, that they, you know, won't have a contract, and there probably is not another company on this peninsula that will pick them up simply because of the issue with Purdue. And, you know, once all the hoopla is over with, the Hudsons will quietly disappear and nobody will know what happened to that farmer.
Given Food Inc. and the lawsuits and what you all have said and... Mm-hmm. It must be kind of hard, though, sometimes.
It is.
It's a normal occurrence, though. I mean, in the years I've been in the industry, sooner or later, every grower, and if they don't realize it, they better look at it now, that they will have their contract terminated or they're going to end up quitting. And it all comes right back to the constant demands of upgrades by the companies. When people start getting to be in older in life, say their 50s, 60s, or 70s, you know, how can they afford to go spend hundreds of thousands of dollars just to stay in the poultry rat race? There's no way. It's not like you're going to live to be 100 years old and still keep making mortgage payments.
You know, what I did on Food Inc. is what many, many farmers would like to do. I mean, it wasn't anything new that I said. It was just something that was hushed in the industry. I mean, as we saw in the movie, old Vince in Kentucky, he wanted to talk, but he wasn't allowed to.
Oh, right. He was a Tyson grower.
He was a Tyson grower. It's not just Tyson. It's the entire industry.
Right.
And I just said what I had to say. I didn't do anything that, you know, tell anybody anything that was new. I just let people know what was going on.
After we toured the farm, I sat down with Carol and Frank in their kitchen. I asked Carol what motivated her to speak out against Purdue.
Well, it's not necessarily Purdue. The Chesapeake Bay is, I would say, my pet. You know, I don't think that any of us have the right, whether you're a farmer, whether you're a golf course, whether you're a development, whatever, none of us have the right to do what is being done to the Bay. You know, it is a pet thing for me. It's a national treasure. My biggest thing is, what do we leave to the next generation? And at this point in time, we're not leaving them much. We've had all of these initiatives set out, you know, through government, through nonprofit organizations, you know, and through the poultry industry, where everybody sits down at a little table and they do behind-the-door deals, and this is what we're going to do. Every single one of them has miserably failed, and it's only getting worse. I'm sick and tired of people saying, I didn't do it. They act like little kids. It's what they remind me of. You know, you got a group of little kids and something happens and each one of them's pointing the finger at the other one and saying, I didn't do it, this one did it. And they give the most ridiculous excuses as to why they didn't do it. And this is what I see happening, and it's been going on for at least 12 years now. In 2000, they really started, you know, trying to make these initiatives to clean up the Bay. Every year it gets worse. We need to stop making deals with everybody and quit denying. And as I said, it's nothing against Purdue specifically. It's the industry. The industry is a polluter of the Bay, point blank. Like it or not, it's happening, and we need to do our part to clean it up. You know, this lawsuit, the only reason that I'm involved in it with on the blog was after I read the public documents, and it became so ridiculous that I just had to say something. You know, I'm used to the industry doing the ridiculous, and it almost amuses me, because, you know, what they're saying is just a bunch of garbage. So it's not that I'm personally involved in this lawsuit. I'm interested in cleaning up the Bay. I don't hate environmentalists. I don't say that the farmers are no damn good and all they want to do is, you know, wantonly pollute the Bay. I think most farmers do their part. But the problem is bigger than what that part is.
When you were on those food ink panels,
mm-hmm.
You got a lot of response from farmers after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I had a personal telephone call from one of the farmers that was in Cape Charles, and needless to say, it wasn't a pleasant conversation. I'm not quite sure what it was he was trying to say to me. I found it very disheartening because, you know, this grower sits at the industry trade union, DPI, representing growers, and he told me point blank he really didn't care what happened on other farms. All he was worried about is his farm. And to me, for somebody who's supposed to be representing the grower in the industry, he should care about the other farms. He should know what the issues and the problems are that the farmers are having. And he just plain doesn't care. So that tells me there is no effort within the industry to try to make it better, to mend the relationship that is supposed to be there between the farmers and the companies. And, you know, I just find that really disheartening. He didn't make me angry. I was just really, really depressed at his whole attitude. You know, and he did make the statement to me that I'm not as something like I'm not as pristine as what I appear to be. I'm not quite sure what that meant. but if anybody thought me as being a pristine person, I'm sorry to have given them an illusion that just is not there.
Do you all think that there are a lot of or a number of people who farm for, whether it's raised chickens for Purdue or for Tyson or for Mount Air, that feel the way you do?
Oh, yes.
But just can't and won't talk?
Definitely. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, well, the problem is the mortgage. They're sitting on farms that have hundreds and thousands of dollars of mortgage due, and they can't take the chance of having a contract terminated. And their company wouldn't openly and say, hey, you said this, and we're going to cut your contract. There's just so many ways that they can manipulate the inputs of your farm. It's unbelievable because you're messing with the man that holds the pencil. There is no way that you can verify any of your inputs.
What do you mean? What do you mean by verify your inputs?
When they deliver chicks, you know, let's say you have four houses. How do you know you get 110 or 120,000 chickens? Are you going to sit there and count them all? By the time you count them all, how many are going to be sitting there dead in the boxes before they get them into the house? Then they could say, oh, you stressed the birds because you were sitting there counting the chicks. The feed. How are you going to weigh that feed? If they say, hey, we delivered 40,000 pounds there, how are you going to measure that? Just because your bin's this much full with feed doesn't mean it's 40,000 pounds. I mean, there's a lot of moisture, you know, into the feed, things of that nature. Or even the nutritional ingredients. You know, did they mix my feed right? Did they send me the right feed for the right age bird? You know, did I receive a flock of primary chicks, the first ones that are hatching, what are known to not do as well as birds that are older? So there are so many ways that they can manipulate your feed or any of your inputs, and you don't know anything about it. You don't find all this out until the flock settles. When the flock moves, that's when they provide you with data.
Of course, they would argue, why would that be in their best interest to do that if they're going to lose money by screwing with you?
How are they going to lose any money? They'll be making money. They pay you less.
And not the, only the, that.
These integrators have been caught years ago doing things like when the farmer's chickens were getting raised, well, the company's chickens were getting weighed that the farmer grew. They would take forklifts and lift the trailers up to reduce the weight because farmers are paid by weight. Or they would put rubber blocks under the scales and the scales only come down so far. Or only put so much feed in that truck and change the ticket. These are things that they've been caught at over the years.
Hmm. Yeah, and not in addition to what Frank is saying, it is well worth the company delivering five bad flocks to a farm for them to settle badly, what they call below average, which gives the company just cause to terminate the contract. Well, you just are a bad grower. That's how it comes off, and they can terminate the contract. It is well worth the company doing that to them than having a grower out there speaking out. I have seen it all over the country. For the past 20 years.
And if you try to go to another company, they're going to say, let me see your six flock rankings.
And it's bad.
It's that, or, hey, look, we might take you on, but you're going to have to change all this equipment. So we're going to upgrade you to the newest design in housing and not pay you that.
I understand that they're probably mortgaged to the ears.
You what?
Well, we were, but we went out and got two and three jobs.
Additional jobs
to pay the mortgage down.
Because we knew this was coming sooner or later.
We knew it was coming.
Yeah.
So we went a lot of years without extras. No vacations, no new vehicles, no this, no that, and cutting back and paying down on the mortgage.
Did lots of oodles noodles.
And it was preparation, and luckily we, were able to manage it. We got it to a manageable size. But there are so many out there that they're just simply not going to say anything, and I understand that.
So, it might sound silly. Would you eat a Tyson Purdue bird?
We do on occasion. Simply because of where we live in this rural area. The only game in town is Walmart. You know, for us to find a decent grocery store where we could buy the type of chicken we wanted to buy, pasture-raised or whatever, we'd have to drive 30 miles. Now that we're raising our own chickens, you know, shortly we'll have our own supply of chicken. But on occasion, we do not eat chicken nearly as much as what we used to. You know, simply because of what we know.
I mean, the commercial chicken and commercial pork to me now is basically has lost flavor in the last 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to add a lot of spice and a lot of vegetables to it. And you have to sort of slice it up thin and mix it up. I mean, if you just take a big chicken breast and cook it, it doesn't have any flavor to it.
It has no flavor.
No.
So how important do you think this case is with Purdue? And what do you think it'll do? How important do you think it is?
It's a game changer.
How so, from your perspective?
If Purdue is found liable or co-liable, as far as the manure goes, it will be set a precedent in this country that integrators who pawn the manure of their animals off onto others are going to have to be responsible for the manure their animals produce, which is how it should be.
Right.
I mean, we have animals here. We're responsible for them. Anyone who has an animal, you know, there's that old saying, he who owns the animal owns the manure or the poop. You know, this is going to be a game changer because every company in this country will be held accountable. And it's time.
It's too many years and too many generations that they have slipped by without taking any responsibility or spending any kind of money on disposing of this manure.
Yeah, and I think what's aggravating about all of it is that they have been able to have tax dollars and others, you know, take care of this problem from their private business. And yet we can't, you know, we have to cut budgets in schools. We have to cut budgets in law enforcement. We have to cut budgets everywhere. But we're still throwing all this money into private business to clean up their mess. And I find that very, very frustrating. This new thing, the windrowing in the poultry houses with the manure, instead of cleaning it out or cresting out, as they call it,
right.
Between flocks, they're piling it up and doing a windrow method and then just spreading it all back out. And it's nothing but poop that the chickens are being put on.
It's dried poop, you know.
That is totally ridiculous.
Do this for 10 or 12 flocks, even one or two flocks.
Yeah.
That's highly concentrated manure.
They're talking
so
18
any type of moisture or anything else is going to release all that ammonia again. And also, when you do that, you're compounding heavy metals. You're compounding copper, arsenic,
zinc,
whatever, cadmium, all the
lead.
Antibiotics, whatever insecticides they use in that poultry house. So in 2 years, that is so enriched with all these chemicals, and then you spread it on the field. And then it's uptaken by the plants and runoff.
It's a vicious cycle,
yeah,
is what
right.
It is.
It just becomes more and more and more potent because they don't check levels of copper or arsenic or any type of insecticides when he had the manure analyzed. It's just NP and K.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of windrow, and not only that, we have antibiotic-resistant bacteria in that manure. How much of that is compounding every time they put chickens on it? You know, and it just makes the problem worse because then you have bacteria. I don't want like to use the word mutate, but it's kind of what it does, that it gets around, you know, the antibiotic. Mm. And the problem's just getting worse. It's not getting better. You know, they like to use the fancy word now, antimicrobial. Mm. Well, to me, I see no difference.
What is it from all the times you all have spent with since this thing broke and you've done Food Inc. and you spent time with, since the 90s, with the chicken catchers and with environmentalists and around the country. What is it that you think the environmental movement in all this is missing? You know, because this, in terms of the way you live your life, in terms of farmers' lives, in terms of what is it you think they're missing that they have to kind of get a hold of and
Here in Maryland,
learn to be
I
more
think they're missing guts. I really do. I think here in Maryland, and even on this peninsula, the environmental groups, powers that be, if you will, they've given too much. They haven't taken a firm stand. They've treated the industry with kid gloves. And, you know, since the year 2000, we're almost to 2012, so for 12 years, this method of treating industry with kid gloves has not cleaned up the bay, has not solved the problems of runoff into the ditches. You know, they need to take a tougher stand. I think they're missing that big time here in Maryland. We're starting to see a little change with new groups coming in, where they're taking a tougher stand. And it's just going to have to happen. I think the difference between the environmentalists and the farmers, there's not an environmentalist that I have had to this farm who has not left here with an understanding of farmers. And I've never had a problem with an environmentalist coming here and just really reading me the riot act about what a bad person I am for farming. I think they get that. You know, it's a system. It is not just one particular sector of that system. I think they get that. I'm glad that I'm not hearing all the time now about environmental issues. Oh, it's those damn farmers again. Because they do get that. So I think the lacking part would be some guts. They need to get some guts and some backbone and say it's enough. Let's get this done.
Yeah, I sort of agree. And they also want to have some type of legislation.
Yeah.
To be enacted. I mean, even, you know, just as far as county level also is only X amount of houses to be built in that county. If we're over, say we own, like we live in Worcester County, let's say there can only be, we're just using a number, let's say just 100 houses, 100 poultry houses, because that's all the land that we have available to spread manure on. All right, you wouldn't be able to build another poultry house until you fall below that number. And there's so many houses that are taken out every year from people having their contracts terminated or fires or hurricanes.
There's
always so many houses that go out anyway. But we have to look at that, you know, county by county and say, hey, look, this is it. I mean, this is all that we can, you know, have in this area before we become saturated.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a theory, and it's a good one. You can only raise so many animals on so much land. And we've gone way beyond that number. So we've thrown everything askew as far as trying to keep that balance. And they just need to go back to it until we can take care of the problems. We're producing way too many chickens on way too little land.
Thanks for listening to Soundbites on Domarva. You've just heard Carol and Frank Morrison, chicken farmers from Pocomoke City, Maryland. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781.